This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last Breath, the podcast about death and dying, brought to you by Hospice Waikato and Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. In the course of my work collecting oral histories, I often hear stories of grief and loss. Occasionally, I ask if a particular story can be shared to this podcast series because it offers a way of understanding grief that may be of help to others, as was the case with Paul Turney. Paul was 17 when his older brother Michael died in a sudden accident. The grief altered the course of Paul's life, and in this interview, he reflects on that experience and what it taught him. Grief doesn't move in a straight line. It loops, revisits, approaches from new angles, withdraws and returns. What changes is not the presence of grief, but our relationship to it. Following the interview is a song called The Elm Tree, which describes Paul's Cambridge childhood in the innocent time before Michael's death shattered his family's world. The elm tree still stands in the yard of his childhood home on the corner of Victoria and Clare Street. This and other songs by Paul Turney and The Human Condition can be found online at bandcamp.com.
I've got a very nice little letter here from my brother Michael, who, when he was very young, it's dated 10th of June 1967. It's got AMDG on the left, and in the middle, what I'm going to be when I grow up. He's in standard four. When I grow up, I will work in Dad's shop. He will need a fair bit of help because he will be old and shaky. In the weeks of May, I will go out duck shooting during the year and will go out to a farm or bush and go deer hunting or rabbit hunting. I will get some good hunting days so that they will be able to collect all the ducks and rabbits. So that was Mike in 1967, standard four.
So Michael was your older brother?
He was a year older than me. Oh, a couple of years, 18 months older than me, yes. He was two classes above me. There were five boys in our family. There was James was the eldest, and then Michael, and then myself, and then Mark, and then John, and then Libby. I mean, in many ways, it was the most ideal upbringing anybody could have. We did a lot of exploring around Te Kutu Lake and places like that, up Mangakawa Hill, out to Mangatauchi, Whitehall, Timaru, Fencourt. We used to ride our bikes out to the dairy factory. Riding our bikes out to Hautapu, which we did quite often actually, we'd often go around the graveyard as well. That was a real favourite spot. My grandfather and my grandmother are out there. My mum and dad are out there, and my brother Mike is out there. So, of course, I always looked up to my brother Mike because he was actually a very nice guy. As a brother, he always looked out for me. And as I was growing up, he would always encourage me to play the piano. I was playing the piano because I was being taught how to play, but after a while I stopped the lessons because I wasn't really enjoying the actual mechanical side of it. I wanted to just sort of venture and do a bit of my own stuff, and I guess that's what I did do. I'm still doing music to this day. But my brother Mike was very encouraging. And I think it's because he was very confident of himself. I think if people have self-confidence. They are inclined to give it away to other people as well. And I think the day that he was killed in Wellington, or he died, he had an accident, that really did knock my confidence, I think, because he was all part of the whole confidence fixture was my brother Michael. He went to pharmacy school on a Thursday and he was killed on the Saturday. And we'd just gone back to boarding school. So we were only back in boarding school for a couple of days when this news came that my brother had been killed. And the one thing I'll say about Michael's death was it was very unfortunate because he had just enrolled and been accepted at pharmacy school in Wellington. And he'd got down there on a Thursday. And to me, it's just like yesterday, all this. So for me, it's just like yesterday. And on the Saturday night, they had a, sort of a freshers' night. Everybody got together and they took them onto a bus. They bussed them out of the city into a Stoke Valley Motor Lodge, which is just out of the city in Stoke Valley. And they all went there together. Everybody was fine. They had a good party, I believe. But when they were all on the bus to come home, they were one short. And nobody thought to go looking for Michael. And that really annoyed the hell out of me, because if there's someone not on the bus, they must be somewhere. And he had fallen into a culvert out the back of this place when he'd had a few drinks, like you do, but it was unfenced and there's no light. And he walked straight into it. He banged his head and apparently he drowned in 2 inches of water. Now, I don't know if he drowned earlier on the night or at the end of the night, but if they'd gone looking for him, they might have found him. And it might have been a different story. I don't know. So I was quite annoyed about that for a long time. I felt it was very unfair. Anyway, I can't do anything about that. Things got very dark for a long time. I feel quite emotional. So I'll just have to pause for a minute. Now, the guy who gave me the news was a very strange brother who was at Sacred Heart College. His name was Bosco Camden, I believe. And he came up to me one day, that particular day, I was mucking around on the organ in this church. I used to get on the organ and play that a bit. And he said to me, "What do you like at taking news?" Which I thought was a really strange question. And I said, "Well, I don't know. Depends on whether it's good or bad news." And he just said, "Oh, your brother's been found dead in Wellington." He might as well have come in with a cricket bat and smacked me over the head with it. That would have been the same effect. I do remember thinking how it couldn't be true. Or maybe it was, but maybe Jamie had gone to, or maybe they've got the places mixed up. Maybe it was Jamie who was killed somewhere. I wasn't sure. I had no idea. I was stunned. And I went outside and I had to find my other brothers and share the news with them, because there were another two of them were at Sacred Heart. There were three of us there. They took it very badly too. John was probably third or fourth one, I don't know. But it would be very tough for John. Anyway, we all had to go back to Cambridge, which we did, and we went to his funeral. We did see him in the coffin before he was buried. Sacred Heart boys came down and formed a guard of honour on both sides of the run-up to the graveside. And there were guys, his friends from Cambridge, who carried the coffin. So it was rather nice, it's as nice as it could possibly have been, I think, in that it was all kind of a lot of young guys there I knew from school. They all had their blazers on. It looked the part. And there we were burying my brother. For me, it was quite a weird time. I don't think I had much of a bright outlook, you might say, on things. I didn't have a particularly good outlook on anything, really. And I guess from that day onwards, I have a very strange relationship with people dying and death and all that kind of business. I try and avoid funerals if I can. I don't sort of put my hand up and go to every funeral that's happening, because they are triggers for me, and I know that, so I won't go to a funeral unless I absolutely have to, unless I know somebody really well. That's all part of the process, is knowing your boundaries, knowing where you can go, where you can't go, what your triggers are. I would say that was February, wasn't it? It's February 75. So we were, I guess that summer, Mike and I used to have a lot of fun. So I was 17, he would have been 19. And he would have just turned 19, because his birthday was the 12th of December. And I was probably 17 and a half, because my birthday's in June. And I do remember he and I used to have a tent, and it was a 10 by 10 tent that we used to take to the camping ground, Mount Maunganui, behind the back of the hot pool. And we used to be with Mum and Dad in our little caravan and an awning, but we eventually got ourselves away, and we had our own tent and our own little site, which we put up on the hill. I think about three or four tents up there. And there were guys from Hamilton Boys High School, because Michael had done 1 year at Hamilton Boys High School to cover his seventh form year. So there were two or three tents up there, and they're all guys who, and girls, who had basically finished schooling. And we had a great time. And I think after having such a great summer, to be confronted with this news was pretty devastating. At the funeral, one of the guys came up to me and said, you know, Mike had asked me to get him some weed to take to Wellington with him, but I didn't get it in time, and I've got it now. What do I do with it? And I said, well, you know, you take half and I'll take the other half. And I took two bags of weed back to boarding school with me. And I suppose I spent a year and a half working my way through it. And that was the only way that I could medicate myself enough to cope with the grief that I was getting. The other thing I did was I did a lot of running, Andrew, and I got very, very fit. I used to run morning and night, so I used to run twice a day. I'd be up about just after 5 in the morning. I'd be out. I'd run out the gate, the front gate of the school, and I'd keep running till about 8 o'clock. I'd come back, have a shower, and go to school. At the end of the day, I would do the same thing again. So I'd just get out of the place as much as I could. And I was in a strange place. I was really in a strange place. And I hadn't been there before, obviously. It was something new to me. And no, I couldn't deal with it at all. It was very bad for me. I found things really difficult. I found I couldn't really concentrate. I got grades and stuff. I passed all my exams, got my UE and all that drama, but I had to get UE two years to get my UE. I think the first year I really couldn't concentrate at all. Second year I got my UE. And then I suppose I was using music as a real crutch. You know, it was actually taking over everything I was doing. Yes, I did know the guys, you know, I didn't know Dave Dobbin. I knew Peter Coleman. So there's Peter Coleman, Dave Dobbin, and who else was Sacred Heart in that band? Peter Ehrlich and Ian Morris. So I knew all those guys. They were in my brother Michael's year. Peter used to take the other boys into his grandmother's house on Fifth Ringing Road. And that's where the dude started rehearsing. So the dudes sort of started with Peter Coleman and Dave Dobbin, Ian Morris, and who am I missing?
Peter Ehrlich?
Peter, yeah. So, and then I got a drummer. I sort of remember seeing that the Island of Reel a lot. Peter would come and pick me up and take me to the Island of Reel. Yeah, so I used to go down and see him. But, you know, for me, it was a bit of a, I don't know, I was a real lost soul, because I really, I used to go down and see these guys playing, and I'd sit there in the audience on my own, thinking, they're all at school with my brother Mike, and they're all still here, and he's not. That doesn't make any sense to me. So I used to find the whole thing quite difficult. And I was probably quite awkward to deal with at that stage. I hadn't had any counselling. I mean, I carried on. You just got to, don't you? You just had to carry on. But I'm sure it wasn't great. It must have been harder for my younger brothers too.
You know, back then, and I experienced this the same. My sister died maybe 2 years before Michael, killed in an accident as well. And, you know, there was no counselling. There was nobody to help you, assist you. You were just left to sort it out for yourself, weren't you?
There was nothing. There was absolutely nothing. You know, I guess there's someone like Bosco in charge of the college. We weren't given any help at all, you know. I don't know whether or not that kind of thing was available in those days. I mean, it might have been available in other countries, but I think New Zealand was sort of still had a sort of a pioneering background, didn't it? And, you know, you sort of just had to get on with things. And I think, you know, at times you just couldn't, you know, I just didn't subscribe to that kind of get on with it type thing. I just think, well, bugger it. I don't really feel like I can get on with it. But some of us weren't that strong, you know. And it wasn't possible to sort of pick up the pieces that were sort of left broken around you to try and work out where you fitted in again, you know. You know, people wouldn't talk to you about it. It's almost like it was something that was not spoken about. I do remember Pat Mullins, who used to run that Mullins Pharmacy. He took a long time to come in and see Mum when he did die, because Pat said he just couldn't know what to say. And of course, he was my brother Michael was doing pharmacy, and he knew Pat very well, and he was going to go into his pharmacy when he graduated. It was going to be a sort of a, that's how the plan had been devised. So, yeah, I mean, it shattered quite a lot of people's sort of plans, I think, then. And, of course, my mum and dad's. And I think because, you know, I guess they were quite stoic. They were, they relied a lot upon religion, on the Catholic faith, to sort of help them through. And, of course, you'd get that support every Sunday. When you fronted up at church, you'd always get that support. And you wouldn't get people looking away. You'd actually get people telling you how sorry they were. And I guess that was a good thing about that kind of upbringing, was that there was that really strong sense of community that was built around the church. But there weren't many people who shared the same tragedy, I suppose, at that stage. And it was, you know, personally for me, it was a hell of a shock. I found myself questioning everything that I've been taught, you know. And I wasn't really happy with everything that I've been taught. I mean, basically, you sort of feel like as a Catholic, you spend your whole life waiting to die, and if you do the right thing, you'll go to heaven. So, you know, just hang in there. it'll be right in the end, sort of thing. But it's not all right in the end, because, you know, there's a lot of life in between. And this whole thing about, you know, purgatory, heaven, hell, now that I've had a bit of time to think about it all, I'm not so sure. And, you know, I also think science has come a long way since then. I mean, you know, a guy goes up the hill, comes back with a tablet and tells everybody he got it from God, and everyone believes him. I find those sort of things quite difficult to believe. And I guess you do start asking questions once you get away from all the, you know, the weekly indoctrinations of your given religion. It's not something I chose. It's something I was born into. And I used to think, what if there is no heaven? What if it's just something that we've made up as a species? Where do dogs go? Where do horses go? You know, where do elephants go when they die? Do they go to heaven? I don't know. You know, why do I believe that if I'm the best I could possibly be for the whole of my life, I will go to heaven? What if I die and that's it? Just like all the other mammals and animals and everything else that lives and dies on this planet. Remember, it's only one planet. And the next galaxy is so far away, we can't even imagine it. And there are billions of galaxies. And here we are going, we're all going to go to heaven when we die. I sometimes think when it comes to life and death, I think when you die, it's like going to sleep, you just don't wake up. So I think because of the way that I was analysing and coming to these conclusions, I decided for me that my best way forward was to leave something that people would be able to mull over when I have gone. And I decided there and then that I was going to get all this recording of mine out of my head and onto some sort of a medium that'll last and last. And I guess being an archivist, as I have been for quite a while before then, I was with the British Library for an awful long time, actually. I decided it was probably a good idea because I'd been organising and archiving loads of other people's stuff, and I realised there's nobody that'd be able to do mine because it was all in my head. So the only way I could get it out of my head would be to record it. So I got a big machine over from France, and installed it in my cellar here. And I worked out a way of making it work with my digital platform. And I've been doing that ever since 2008. I've been doing that. That's really the story about why I've got this recording system here, why I do the recordings. I wanted my children, my two daughters, to have something of me that they could refer back to, I think, at times. You know, I have some stuff with my dad that I can refer back to, but not much. When I was a boy, we used to have a standard 8, which had no sound, but it had a very good picture. So we had the colour film, but we never actually had any audio that went with it. So what I wanted to do was try and bring everything together. And now I've got an amazing array of drives here. I've got two boxes, and each box has got 20 drives, and each drive is quite a large drive. And a lot of it's got my archiving for my clients on it, but also family stuff. And with my kids growing up, I felt it was really important that I film them as well, and I make an archive of them. And I have about 8 terabytes of... So I've been doing that. I've been archiving the fact that my kids have grown up from obviously very young children to the people they are now. We go away on holidays now. I still take film of them. Grace is 24 years old today, and Ella is 27. So it's been a good, you know, good 27 years of recording the girls. So it's a really large archive, actually.
This is kind of your response to Michael's death and the effect that it had on you, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of trying to hold on to those memories that were there, because they were real to me, very real to me. And I think I wanted to carry on. My father used to do quite a lot of filming, which was really lovely. And, of course, Mike's in them. He'd be coming up to 69 years old this year. So I guess, you know, I always think he died at 19 and he's lost all that time and all the time that we could have been doing stuff together, you know, as a family. It's all gone. I guess I wanted to hang on to whatever I could. I think when we had Ella, Lindsay and I were living in Barron's Court, and I had a good relationship with Sony. Sony, of course, make all this equipment, which is helpful. Sony Broadcast Professional. And so I got a lot of camera gear from them, actually. It really, you know, wasn't expensive at all. And it meant that I could start recording almost immediately. Times that I had with the kids when they were born, and there's just so much of that film. It's incredible. There's some very funny bits in there when they were young, when they used to talk to each other. It was just so cute. And you know, if you don't film it, you don't have it. It's gone. The other thing is, when I was doing this, when I was filming a lot of this, I was being told to stop doing it. You know, my wife would say, "Stop it! You know, you're always filming. You're always filming. We don't want to be in the film. We don't want this film." And now, when they see it now, it's like, "Oh, God! I'm so pleased you didn't stop. You know, I'm so pleased you carried on filming." But I was always going to. You know, it's almost like being in the middle of a performance. Someone saying, "Stop! No, you don't stop. You keep going."
Your recording project. First album is Thoughts and Prayers, and the second album is Saints and Sinners.
Yes.
This is your way of reaching into the future. So you're going to die, you're going to go to sleep, and that's the end of it. But what you have created will live on. That's your way of reaching to the future and creating a sort of immortal version of yourself.
I would like to think that there was something there. I mean, you're probably doing the same thing, Andrew, by, you know, the recordings that you're doing.
Well, I think you know, you're kind of right. We have chosen similar paths. And when you're very young and you lose a sibling, not if you've got cancer, it's a slower death. You have time to prepare yourself mentally. But when it happens, like Michael fell into a culvert and drowned in 2 inches of water. My sister was run over by a school bus, and it happens very, very quickly. And you're unprepared. And I was just like you. I just didn't believe it. I remember sitting in the church, looking at her coffin, her little wee white coffin, and going, "This is not true. This just does not happen."
No, it's like an act of fiction, isn't it?
And if I shake myself hard enough, I'll wake up from this dream, and she won't be in that coffin anymore. And I remember. The grief that I felt was so painful, so profound, that a year after that, I promised myself I would never allow myself to feel that degree of emotion ever again. I just couldn't imagine ever having to face that again. And it shifts you. People come up to you and go, "Oh, I'm sorry it happened," and they say all kinds of things, but nobody asks you how you're really feeling. Can I help you? What can I do for you? And you just struggle, and you drown.
Yes, yes.
You drown. You said to me, last conversation we had, you said to me, after Michael died, you became a lost soul.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very dark. It was a really dark period of my life. It went on for years and years and years. In actual fact, I think the light didn't really start shining in my life until I got married to Lindsay, my wife. Until then, I felt like there was nothing much at all going on where I was particularly relevant. Or what I did was relevant. You know, I did a lot of things. I know I did a lot of things. But I'm not sure whether my heart was in it, you know.
18 years from that time, 18 years, almost 20 years go past till you meet Lindsay and you suddenly found yourself again.
Meeting Lindsay was nice. You know, we just, one thing led to another. Of course, we had Ella. Then we decided we'd have another child, and Lindsay became a consultant. She passed the papers. She became a dermatology consultant, which meant she had to go and find a hospital where she would be working for the rest of her working life. And she was accepted down here in Swindon. And so we've moved out to Cirencester, the Cotswolds. And Grace was born in 2001. So it's been hard work. None of it's been easy, but I think if you work hard and things do come right, and I think she was the key to me, things coming right for me in many ways. Being medical as well, I think she kind of helped. She did psychology as well as part of her modules. So she knew a thing or two about what goes on inside people's heads. And she was able to help me along quite often. She would just reassure me, or she was great. And, you know, I've been very lucky. And, of course, my daughters have got a wonderful mother. So all in all, it's been absolutely brilliant, you know.
Do you still feel visceral grief for the loss of Michael?
I think, yes, I do all the time, but I think you just learn to live with it. And I think part of living with grief is learning to live with grief, you know. It's never going to go away, you know. Time will help.
What has that grief taught you? You know, since then, your parents have died, you've had friends that you've lost. Have you been able to cope with that better from that experience of losing Michael?
Yes, I would say so. Yes, my coping with death is probably a lot more mature now. And I think, you know, when it comes to grief, I think you have to compartmentalize it and you have to put it aside. You have to try and leave it, if you can, leave it aside, because there's a lot to be done in a lifetime. And I think you need to really, sometimes you really need to get on with it.
Do you ever think what ifs about Michael?
I do have a lot of what ifs about Mike. Things probably wouldn't have developed as they did had it not happened. You know, the sliding doors thing, you know, if we'd gone on this way or that way, which, what would have happened? I don't know. But I think perhaps we would have stayed in Cambridge for longer. Probably my parents would have stayed in Cambridge if Mike hadn't been killed. I think they needed to get out of there at some stage in their lives. And I really didn't appreciate the grief that a parent has for the loss of a child. Until becoming a parent myself, and I think, you know, probably the worst case scenario is that. So I park all that aside, and I think, well, it would have been great. I think our family would have been a much tighter unit if it hadn't happened. But things do happen, you know, and people develop and change. And As a family, I think we kind of exploded. And I think we all went our own ways and we came back together, and sometimes it didn't work. So it seemed to be better to stay away, stay apart. I found that New Zealand was a very right-wing-leaning place to live in. And I realised that was part of my problem with getting on with some members of my family, was that they were very much right-wingers. And I just never, we could just never agree on things. And I found that really difficult. I think you've got to have empathy and you've got to have some kind of concern for other people, you know. It's not all about yourself. It's not all about your family. I think you've still got to be part of the bigger picture. And I always saw myself as being part of the bigger picture. And insulation, it doesn't really work, you know. There is the old saying, you know, no man is an island. And it's true, you know, you don't get on in life just by looking after yourself all the time. You have to reach out to other people and help other people with the knowledge you have or with the experience you've gained. And that's all really, really all we can do in life. There's nothing much more to it than that.
You've healed.
Yeah, I reckon the healing process has happened. It happened over a long time. It was made better by having a family, putting some roots down, you know. I sort of find myself here in the UK, in England, which I never thought I would be. I thought I was only going to be over here for 6 months. That was almost 30 years ago. I'm still here. I found a woman who loves me, so that was really handy. And I've got a lovely family. I've got an amazing house, got an amazing place where I live. So, you know, why would I not feel as if I'd somehow healed, you know? The healing process, I think, is different for everybody. It'd be different for each of my brothers and my sister. My parents, I think my mother found it extremely difficult. Bless her soul. She found it very difficult. And she really didn't have a chance to heal, I don't think. I think she sort of... But I think, yes, I think I'm probably healed. I'm doing my thing. I'm pretty confident that what I'm doing is correct. And if it's not, I'll go back and do it again, you know. But I'm able to do that. I'm able to sort of work in an environment where I sort of feel happy with what I'm doing. I feel happy with my tools and I feel happy with what I make. And hopefully it's good enough, you know. Just do my best, really. I've always just done my best. And hopefully it's good enough for whoever is going to come by and mark my homework.
When we were young, we played like it's play today. Until we grew up to depart, played on the fields. They seem so long when we walk to school through the railway yard, climb the wooden gate, walking in the rain just to ride the train. When I return to this place, so many years have passed, so I did notice the change. Railway lines don't last. I slip out my door and lose my mind. Let the grand piano play. It's the best part of the day. coming down the track. At supper time, we wait for the call. The higher you climb, it's further to fall. Would be truly brave. Don't turn your head away, that would be a shame. When genuine mistakes appear on the printed page, we turn our attention to the life we must sustain. So we're driving down. Hold the rope, yeah. I won't let you fall. I'm coming down. I'm coming down. I'm coming down.
Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.